All right, nice to have you back with us on this Saturday night. Bruce Jenkins, how are you? How are things going?
Pretty good, Marty. Pretty stable. Lucky to have a job and be busy and have my family around really more than ever. So, you know, I can't complain. I'm feeling very lucky.
Good, good, good. Well, it looks like baseball, we're going to talk about it as the show goes on, but it looks like baseball is setting the stage at least to reveal a plan. I don't know if they'll be able to do it, but they are going to come up with something. And one thing I thought of talking to you about, I mean, they are talking about a West Coast division, which is bring back the Pacific Coast League. They might as well rename the teams. You know, here comes the PCL
let's play. Let's play in Emeryville and Seal Stadium. You know,
I mean, honestly, you know, the travel would be very limited, and you would have Seattle and San Diego, and you'd have the two L.A. teams, like the Stars and the Angels. I don't know. It is kind of reminiscent of that.
Yeah, I think they've got Houston in there, too. I mean, there's a lot of geographical issues with the way they divided it up, which would have to be. There's no way you can divide it up into three divisions and dismiss the American National Leagues and have everything all of a sudden be as convenient as Giants and the A's or, White Sox and the Cubs. So there's an awful lot of issues in the way. I think you're right. I think they're going to try something. And, that gives people hope. I'm more inclined to think, I sure hope they can pull it off to just pounding away at all the negatives, because there really are a lot of them. I think they're really bucking the odds here as far as testing and everything else and all the things that can go wrong. But they're trying, and they've discarded the plans that don't sound so good. They're dealing with ones that sound a little better, so that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, so we'll see. But, the thing with the money at the end of May, there's no obligation to the employees, the players, the coaches, everybody else. So they have to have something in place by the end of May to at least let people know what's going on. But I'm with you. I miss the stories. I miss the drama of the game. But the health of everyone involved is paramount. So you and I have talked this way since this thing started. So nothing different, although they are going to come up with a plan. That's the one thing I see coming.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty well assured that there won't be people in the stands at the beginning, and that'll be pretty awkward. But I think for people who are really into the game, we're going to be welcoming the side of baseball. I just hope they don't pipe in fake crowd noise. I've actually heard that's being considered. I mean, right away you've got a phony product. Come on, you're not fooling anybody. Don't do that.
No, I was thinking about Rennell. Would Rennell be there? I think they do want to play the games in the home cities. I think that they do want to do that. But would you have the PA announcer? I guess you would. Why not?
Oh, well, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing more real than Rennell, or any of the great PA announcers around the game. You think about Bob Shepard and John Ramsey and Schirmfeller, and maybe pipe in some of those people who are no longer with us, but just for a little relief there between innings. But no, if somebody like Rennell would be great, because she's very enthusiastic and it's completely genuine and appropriate. So I think that would add a lot.
Hmm. You ever meet Bob Shepard, the great voice of the New York Yankees?
Oh boy, I never did. I got to know the who was the stadium organist there? Great organist. He was I forget. You could hear him. You're coming in. You smell the pretzels. You're coming in off the subway through the Bronx, and you're walking into the stadium, and you hear Eddie Layton. You hear Eddie Layton on the organ and Bob Shepard, and I did meet Eddie Layton a little bit because I love good musicians, and I never met Bob Shepard. I think if I had, it would have been sort of like running into Joe DiMaggio. I wouldn't even know what to say because he was such a legendary guy for so many decades.
Yeah, I got to meet him only once at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Leonard Coppett invited me to go up there, and Leonard arranged that I could be part of the Otisaga Hotel, that I could eat breakfast there. And I thought I was dead. I thought I was in heaven watching. seriously, Robin Roberts walking around and all these people, and then all of a sudden, I heard Bob Shepard's voice, and I was sitting on that veranda, which is like about 100 yards wide, and you're just looking out at the lake. Mm-hmm. And I heard his voice, and I had my tape recorder with me. I was doing that stuff. And I did sit down with him, and he recited a poem to me about Tracy Stallard, who gave up Roger Maris his 61st home run. And just to hear his voice, very gracious man, very gracious man.
You expected that because there was a lot of class and gentlemanly nature and understatement in his calls.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Jeter, number two, short. Yeah. You know, well, the best compliment is Jeter recorded him even after he passed away.
How great is that? Come on. That's just the best.
When Jeter came up, Bob Shepard was the one. How about that? That's actually probably one of Jeter's best moments. You know that?
Yeah, and as I say, when you went to the old Yankee Stadium, not the oldest old, but, you know, old before the new, to be able to experience stuff like that in the 80s, like I did, and go to old-timers games and hear and see people that had been there for so long, the tradition is just, it overwhelms you. That's such a big part of the game, and anyone who was able to do that was very fortunate.
Did you get to have lunch or breakfast in the Oda Saga and sit in that room with everybody?
Yes. I did. The only Hall of Fame ceremonies I covered were the ones where Bob Stevens and Orlando Cepeda went in.
Oh, perfect.
And which, of course, was a great one for the Bay Area, but I tried to experience everything that I could. I think I just, you know, I dropped by the Oda Saga. I wasn't staying there. I didn't feel like I should be suddenly part of, you know, anybody's little gathering or party, but to be on the deck out there, you see the things you see. You see, you know, there's Brooks Robinson and Jim Palmer and then Frank Robinson and Al Kaline, you know, and like you say, maybe you'll hear Bob Shepard and you're looking out at the lake. And like you say, I might be dead here. I might have moved on.
Yeah, I thought so. I swear to you. I said, this has got to be heaven. It's one of those, you know, one of those field of dreams things. That's a good one. Yeah, I got to watch Tom Seaver's 300th win. MLB had that on this week. And it was just a great game. You and I have talked about this. You know, Tony La Russa left him in probably 120, 130 pitches. I don't know how many. He had nothing at the end, Bruce. His last two innings, nothing. He had to spot the ball. They weren't going to take him out. The Yankee Stadium crowd was going nuts because he was with the White Sox. And he got his 300th win. But my point is this. I miss the drama of baseball and then those moments. They can't be replaced and we don't have them.
And you miss the class of not only La Russa, but in those days, it was 1985. It's not like a million years ago, but it's quite a while ago. But if somebody had a no-hitter going, especially somebody like Seaver, of course you left him in. And I was looking it up. I mean, in the bottom of the eighth, there's two on and two out. Oh, my God. But he strikes out Winfield get out of that. Now in the ninth, this is when the eras clash. With a guy on and two out, he walks Dan Pasqua. Okay, so the modern-day manager says, oh, well, that's it. I'm going out to get him. You know you aren't, you idiot. It's Tom Seaver, for Christ's sake. And he left him in. Don Baylor came up to pinch hit, and he got him, and he got the no-hitter. And that's just that's the way it should be. Forget the pitch count.
Yeah, yeah. The Winfield strikeout was, I don't know, a slider away or whatever it was, but it was in a perfect spot, and there's no way that Winfield could have touched it. And Harold Baines made a couple of big plays. You know, of course, Harold Baines, Hall of Famer forever, will be known as, why is he a Hall of Famer? But there was a time when Harold Baines was a hell of a player.
He was a hell of a player all the way, just like Veda Pinson and Johnny Callison and Tommy Davis were hell of a players all the way. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean, for my money, you go into the Hall of Fame for all those guys, including Baines, but, oh, my God, yes. I mean, tremendous hitter. I just, he never really struck me as one of, like, those guys, like an Eddie Murray or, you know, somebody who, Joe Morgan, where you just knew right on the spot, having watched him for a few years. But, Harold Baines, tremendous. Another thing, Marty, Seaver that night in Yankee Stadium, and this is like his second of the last year in the bigs. He's not a young man. He's not with the Mets, but he's in New York. The first four hitters in the Yankee lineup, Ricky Henderson, Ken Griffey Sr., Mattingly, and Winfield. I mean, that's a pretty good load.
Yes, and he maneuvered his way. They didn't take him out.
Yeah.
And you know, they had, I forget who was warming up, like Bob James or something like that, you know. And they wouldn't, you know, Dave Duncan went out to the mound and Fisk was massaging him through the thing. And it was a great moment. It was just a great moment. So my question to you, and I asked this earlier, Woe and Bill Lasky, you know, for dramatic moments for you, when you think of baseball, give me some of your favorite dramatic moments that you personally had. And it may be a World Series, may not be a World Series.
Well, in 1979, that was the first time I got to go out and cover the postseason. I did the entire thing, starting with the National League playoffs on, and I was with Pittsburgh all the way. And by the time they got to the World Series, actually before that, when they finished off the National League playoffs in Pittsburgh, and the whole stadium was singing We Are Family, it sounds really corny, but it was extremely classy and cool and soulful at the time. And I just thought, you just got swept into it. I mean, you could be a Reds fan sitting in Three Rivers back then and you get swept up in that. I never forgot how amazing that was. Or the sound at Candlestick in 89 after Will Clark singled up the middle against Mitch Williams. It's still just ringing in my ears, you know. I'm still staring at the field thinking, God, how unbelievable, you know, that happened. So many things, and you know, I go back. I'm 117 years old, but
no,
watching Koufax finish off the Yankees in the 1963 World Series, he won the opener in New York, and he closed them out in L.A. And, you know, forget about it. You know, just God. And we all have these things. You know, we've got a project where we're reaching out to fans at the Chronicle and asking them for their favorite moment that they've ever enjoyed in sports. And we're really getting some great ones. You're going to enjoy this, especially from the baseball aspect. This one guy wrote in and said he went to a game where McCovey came up and he hit one. Looked like it was about 8 feet off the ground, and it hit something in right field so loud, you know, you thought it was an earthquake or something, and he just thought, geez, if that had been just 6 inches above Bobby Richardson, you know, stuff like that is just so great.
Yeah, yeah, the drama. And, you know, I guess we're just so caught up, of course, health-wise and all that, but in baseball we're caught up with the labor union and the draft and the umpires getting less money and prorating this and service. There's just so much stuff going on that you forget the game. The game is what it's all about, you know, those moments that you never forget. And that's what I'm missing. I'm missing.
Yeah, and, you know, it's forget the nostalgia. I mean, just last year, you know, the way Washington pulled out that World Series. I mean, you can have all sorts of weird thoughts about what the Astros were doing, but the fact is the Nationals did win that with a lot of old-school baseball, a lot of singles, you know, a lot of changing the signs so they didn't get them stolen, and amazing clutch hitting and great starting pitching performances, and you know, right up to date. I mean, the game never really disappoints, especially in the postseason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why, you know, just to get the games back, and who knows if they will. I know they have their plan, but that's what we miss. We miss that, and what made me think of the Seaver moment. Look, I wasn't there. I'm watching it on TV, and I had goosebumps. I mean, it was just, it was like one of the great moments. So that's how I feel about it. Grant Brisby is doing something in The Athletic, which I really like, and he's going to join the show a little bit later. But he's counting down his 50 favorite Giant home runs.
Mm-hmm.
And today,
I know, I've been following that. Grant is great.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's great. The thing about it is when he proposed it, I sent him an email or said Twitter or something. I said, you know, I hope Santiago is up there high, because when Santiago hit that home run in the 2012 series against the Cardinals, that he got the Giants even in that series. I mean, if he doesn't hit that homer, the Cardinals may well win the pennant, and the Giants don't win that second title. Well, he had him at number 29, I think, and one of the ones ahead of him was Cepeda hitting his first big league homer on the Giants opening day in 58, and they go, really? But, you know, if you think about it, that was an amazing thing. I mean, here are the Giants, it's their first game ever, they want to put on a show, and of course they did, they smoked the Dodgers, but Cepeda, that everyone heard of, sure enough, he parks one out, it was a blowout at the time, but a big, big moment. So, I mean, I'll leave it up to Grant to do his personal calls, and it's great, and I hope people are digesting that.
Yeah, he's doing a great job of bringing you into the moment. I said this is his best writing. So number 30 today was Mays' home run off Spahn. In the 16th inning. That was number 30. Number 29 was Benito Santiago, game four.
That's the one,
yeah. 28 was Cepeda. Mm-hmm. 27 was Bonds hitting a home run the day he came back after his father had passed away.
And off Randy Johnson?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's a great one that he put in there. I mean, who really remembers that in this context? But, you know, his father had died, and he's not the same Bonds, really, you know, throughout the day, throughout all those days. Yeah. And imagine a lefty hitter getting up there against Randy Johnson anytime, anywhere, anybody. And he puts one into the night, you know, to honor his dad. Come on, that's just beautiful.
And then the last for today is McCovey from June 27th of 1977. And it was the second time in his career that he had hit two home runs in one inning. But the second one was a grand slam, and he passed Hank Aaron for the National.
Big.
Yeah, as Grant did his research, and he had some Willie McCovey quotes, that as Willie was rounding the base, he says, "Boy, I've passed Hank Aaron." And so I thought that was pretty good. I liked it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been a really good feature. I can't wait for the next installment. But, McCovey, I mean, to hit two homers in an inning twice, I mean, then you think, hell, he could have done it easily three or four more times. I mean, he was that great. He was that fearsome.
Oh, amazing. So then then I went to the other end of the spectrum. And, you know, I love looking up this day in baseball history because, there's some moments that, we don't have today that we can at least look back on. And the name Doc Ellis came up. And I just said to Woe and Lasky, I said, I say the name Doc Ellis, what do you think about it? And, of course, they thought about him pitching a no-hitter on LSD.
Yeah.
And that is his moment. But he had another moment on May 1st of 74. And I don't know if you remember this one, when he pitched against the Reds and he hit the first three batters, and he said he was going to hit everybody because he didn't like the Reds.
The great thing about Doc Ellis is that he loved his drugs and he was a wild man and he came up with crazy things, but he pitched a long time. He persevered in the game, which there's an awful lot to be said for that.
Yes, and he did, and he had Rose, Morgan, and Dreesen.
Oh,
just hit
geez.
Him. That's it. And Art Howe told me the story because Art Howe was on the Pirates at the time, and he said they were sitting here, we couldn't believe it. And then he tried to hit Tony Perez, and he couldn't hit him, but he walked him on four pitches.
Jeez.
And then he tried to hit the next guy on two pitches, and then they finally took him out. Danny Murtaugh said, "Are you okay?" No, I'm not.
What a question to ask Doc Ellis, right?
Yeah, right. So the last part of the story.
He could say he's okay, and it doesn't mean anything to anybody else.
It was great. The last part of the written story that I read was about Doc Ellis. He was on the Rangers, I guess, at this point. And he comes at the end of the season. He's got a bag full of money, like $3,000 in $20 bills. And he hands it to Richie Zisk and Kurt Bivakwa. And they said, "Well, what is this for?" He says, "Well, the whole season I've been signing your name to room service. And I just wanted to pay you back." So
the guy pitched 12. I'm looking at the stats. He pitched 12 years. Won 138 games. He was in the Cy Young picture with the 71 Pirates. He's a 19-game winner. Many years later with the Yanks, he wins 17, and he's still pitching in 79. I mean, good grief. That's him. To think that he was that wild of a character, but had so much talent that you had to have him. Well, I guess a lot of teams had to have him, but he was good. He was a good one.
Yeah, and he turned his life around. He did a lot of good things with counseling and all that kind of stuff. So That's a story. All right. So a couple more things. One, your column today about Brian Sabian. You and I have touched on this before in the show. Absolutely Hall of Famer. Absolutely a Hall of Famer. And I'm glad you went through some of the trades for the Giants, because there have been some fabulous trades that he made. They very rarely get the short end of a trade.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even get into what he did in 97, where he, in the middle of the season, the trade with the White Sox and Wilson Alvarez, and that completely got the Giants in the playoffs. You know, so, there's always some clown out there going, hey, what do you mean? You know, he never developed an outfielder. Well, how about Panic, Duffy, Crawford, Belt, Posey? Mm-hmm. You know, there's your infield, the entire infield and rotation. That's not good enough for you? You know, I mean.
Well, you're right. And, you know, you mentioned Theo Epstein and Cashman and these people, but Brian Sabian did the Yankee thing. And and I've got hours with him. I got about 6 hours that I taped with him last year in spring training. And I played part of it as, you know, as the season went on last year. There's no doubt in my mind that he is a Hall of Fame baseball general manager. No doubt.
Boy, no doubt. No doubt. I just love the presence that he had. You know, he'd be sort of standing off to the side there. He's almost like a mob figure to me. He was, he looked kind of dangerous, and he wasn't like, he's hardly a chest beater, or, you know, he had a deep voice. He didn't really say a whole lot. I'm sure he did to you, though. When he got into a good interview, you could really, he could draw him out, and he was fantastic. But just a marvelous presence to the guy, very old school. And he did so many things for both of the organizations. I mean, Theo Epstein obviously has to get in for, you know, getting the Red Sox off the curse, you know, and the Cubs. But Sabian is a little bit older, and he's done more. He's got more titles, and he's the first guy for me in line.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm so glad you wrote it. I hope this gets a little bit of momentum. I know a lot of, obviously, people all over the country read your stuff, and I hope it gets some momentum when it comes up again. Theo Epstein's
got to get in. Just really quick, the good thing about it is that he did have such an East Coast presence that all those voters back there are well aware of him. That's a good thing.
Well, if they're still alive, people are getting older. So, boy, did you see Kevin Kernan got released by the New York Post?
Yeah, it's so brutal. You know, he's one of those guys. John Shea had a nice tribute to him on social media. He's been around a really long time. Always a class act. Always consistent. Hardline reporter.
Yeah.
No nonsense. Always told it how it was. Which in New York, you know, you get a lot of grief. You know, and you gotta be right more often than you're wrong. And he was one of those guys. And I always loved seeing him. I always had a real good relationship with him. It's always great when you're in New York or he comes out here to kind of catch up with him. Guys like him are hard to replace, and he won't really be properly replaced, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, New York Post, America's most beloved sports writer, Kevin Kernan. And, you know, it's funny when he would come out here, and Raph knows this, and, you know, we have so many archives. We could just I could have my own network and just play all this stuff every day. I'd say to Kevin, well, let me record something with you. You know, the Mets are here, whatever. He'd say, no, I want to come on live. And he would come out there live, and he would just steal the show because he was so direct. And,
yes.
You know, New York all the way. New York all the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, get into situations back there where you're confronted by, you know, Steinbrenner or Billy Martin or God knows what it is, you know, and you got to stand there and be ready with some answers, you know, and be a man. And that's not a job everybody can do.
No.
And I always admired guys like Kevin because he was exactly one of those guys.
No. New York is a different, you know, to just digress a little bit out of left field, but to watch Andrew Cuomo every day. And just the way he talks and takes on the press. I mean, you know, this is the New York press. And, you know, he shut the subway down for 4 hours, you know, so the clean, you know, and he's got to deal with that.
Unbelievable.
That's New York, you know. So
a
writer like Kevin Kernan, I'm glad I could mention him, Kernan.
I don't know how old he is, but I hope, you know, he's in a position to retire or semi-retire because he's, Lord knows, he's had a great career and zero regrets, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, he lives in St. Augustine, Florida now.
So, okay, well, there he's halfway there.
Yeah, yes, so he's there.
He just needs a lounge chair.
He puts a picture out on Facebook every morning of the sunrise, that kind of thing.
Oh, boy.
So he's not complaining.
No.
This Wednesday is Willie Mays' birthday, and I asked this to Bill and to Woe. The first time you met Willie Mays, do you remember that, Bruce?
I'm trying to think. It was quite a while ago, early Candlestick years. I remember I remember it better from in the mid '80s. We used to have a hardball game out at Candlestick. It was the media against the Giants front office, and we played on a Saturday with a team on the road. Corey Bush and Duffy Jennings got it together, and I was putting together a media team with a few ringers, and they'd have people that work for the Giants. And one day, I'm out in left field. I may have told you this, but the guy gets up to the plate for the Giants, and he's like imitating Mays. I go, who's this guy think he is? Well, it was Mays.
Really? No, I never heard this story.
It was Mays, you know, and we all got to kind of, you know, chat with him a little bit, and he popped up to Bud Geraci that time. But the next time up, he just stung a single to center. We're all like, yeah, you know, there he is, you know, but just great. I mean, and you know, what's great about it right now is that John Shea has this, what I'm certain is a unbelievable book about Mays, with nothing but fresh quotes from Mays all the way through. And I think Willie's going to be here to see it. Well, he is here to see it, and that's very special.
Yep, it's coming out, I think, May 12th, I thought I saw that.
Yeah, we're closing in.
Yeah, it's an outstanding book, and it's funny, John was promoting the audio book today. And, of course, he talked about, you know, certain people do the voice of Mays and the voice of other people and this and that. And then he said at the end, there's John and Willie do a one-on-one where they ask questions. And I was there because I set it up, you know, because John didn't know what he was doing. And I had to get the tape recorder and the whole thing. I had a tape recorded for him. And then I got to ask a few questions, too, which, of course, I'm not part of the audio book. But to be there, and Willie was so engaged. It was like a good day. And it was just incredible to hear him. You didn't even have to ask him the question. He just started talking. And it really is just amazing to listen to. So John did a great job. He did a great job with the book. It's really something else. It's going to be a good one. The other one is Joan Ryan. You mentioned her book. We hadn't mentioned that on the air yet.
No, yeah, I got a copy of that. And I knew that she'd been working on this for a long time, 10 years or so, and about chemistry in the clubhouse. But it wasn't just, you know, the Giants of you know, coming together and winning in 2010 with some weird cats like Aubrey Huff, or you know, the A's, you know, were big brawlers and they didn't really like each other, but they came together. But she went so much deeper than that. She went into the science of it, and she talked to neurologists and sociologists and people who understood the study of the human brain and how interactions with people so much affect us. And you're reading along with this, and it's just, it all rings so true, how you act differently in certain company. Most of us do, anyway. And we withdraw in company that doesn't do much for us, and we just want to get the hell out of there. So it's just things like that, but it's so well explained. It's very scientific, but it's also extremely, you know, it doesn't get any more than Aubrey Huff in a thong, you know, I mean, or Jim Leyland, you know, just puffing away on a cigarette during his interview. And it's actually totally covered the spectrum on the thing, and the conclusion is that there absolutely is something to it, and you don't measure it by championships. You know, you measure it by what you're seeing at the time, and maybe you don't win it, but, you know, here's 25 guys, you know, 7 or 8 of whom you match them up, you go, zero chance these guys would have anything to say with each other at any time, and the next thing you know, the group dynamic works to the point where they're, you know, they're good friends, maybe not for life, maybe so, but for that particular time and that particular social interaction, you know, they play their butts off and they get along and they're a force to be reckoned with. It's very cool.
Yeah, I saw it, I think, with the 70s A's, the early 70s A's.
That's what I was referring to with the teams that had a lot of strife. But, man, you get them out on the field, forget about it.
And I think the Giants team of 89.
Yeah. And she gives a lot of credit to Kruko, who is much deserving of that. I was so fortunate to be able to go into the clubhouse and year after year with the Giants in his prime with the Giants. After you talk to the manager, you go into the clubhouse for a perspective, and you look for guys like Kuiper and Brenly, and especially Kruko. You know, this guy won the McCovey Willie Mack Award twice, which is pretty hard to do. It's like the most guy who represents the spirit of the Giants. more than anybody else. And he's just like he is today, really. But to think that he was that way as a player, and that bright and perceptive and funny and critical, you know, he was just he was amazing. But he's really the epitome of what Joan is talking about. And she dedicated the book to him, and he's one of those guys that makes it seem so real.
I'm looking forward to getting a copy of it and getting her on the show. All right. Well, I wish you a good week and everything be healthy.
You too, Marty. It's going good out here so far. Just hope it continues.
Yeah, we're gonna we'll get some baseball news over the next week or so. I got a feeling.
Okay, sounds good to me.
It's coming. All right, take care, Bruce. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.
All right, that is the great Bruce Jenkins. More coming up.